What happens when you knowingly open your own Pandora's box? Katrina Brown and nine of her relatives decided to investigate their ancestral involvement in the slave trade, and together they went on a trip that took them from Rhode Island to Ghana to Cuba and back, the route of the triangle trade that made their ancestors, the DeWolfs, the largest slave trading family in U.S. history. Her documentary film, Traces of the Trade, A Story from the Deep North, is being screened tonight, or today at 1:30 and then tonight at 9 as part of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival at the Walter Reed Theater. And it will be broadcast on Channel 13 as part of the PBS screenings of it tomorrow night at 10 o'clock. I'm very pleased that all of that brings Ms. Brown to the show today. Hello.
Hello.
Who were the DeWolfs and where did they live?
They lived in Bristol, Rhode Island, and they have the unfortunate status of being the family most invested in the slave trade by virtue of having been involved for three generations over more than 50 years.
And they lived in Rhode Island, not in the South.
Correct. I assumed when I found out about this involvement of theirs that they must have been the exception in the North, you know, the only ones, and quickly discovered that they were basically the tip of the iceberg of this much larger pattern of New England's complexity.
They were just the most successful.
Yep.
Does most of the family's inherited wealth come from the trade?
There are lots of DeWolf descendants now, so I don't know everybody's situation, but the folks that I've been working with, we didn't inherit money directly from the slave trade, but one could certainly say that we indirectly inherited all kinds of privileges.
Because you went to the best schools and you lived in the best places.
Yep.
And married into the best families.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these people no longer have the name DeWolf, including you.
Right.
So how did you wind up gathering these people together, some of whom – are any of them still named DeWolf?
My cousin Tom DeWolf is, and he's actually written a book about our experiences called Inheriting the Trade. So he was the only one, although oddly enough, his family story is a little different than ours, but – yeah.
Did you know each other before?
I had one first cousin who came on the trip, and the rest are all, you know, everything from second, third, and seventh cousins. So we were, a lot of us, strangers to each other.
Now, you started your itinerary in Bristol, Rhode Island. Then you went to Ghana and then to Havana, Cuba. Why that route?
The DeWolfs, so part of what they did was what we would call today vertical integration, where they really developed all aspects of the business in order to capitalize on it most effectively. So they had rum distilleries in Bristol, Rhode Island, the rum, and they had ships. So they would take rum to the west coast of Africa to trade for human beings. The Africans were taken to mostly to Havana, Cuba, and Charleston, South Carolina, but really all over the Caribbean and the southern states and somewhat to the northern states. They then developed plantations in Cuba. So they had sugar and coffee plantations. The sugar was then brought up back to Rhode Island to make the rum. So they had the circle route. Yep. And they had auction houses in Charleston. So.
And that also allowed them to continue in the slave trade past the point where it was illegal in the United States?
Well, here comes the other surprise. In the sort of – we all know that Thomas Jefferson has a mixed legacy on the issue of slavery, and we learned of some more chapters in that. He appointed the DeWolf's brother-in-law to serve as the customs official in the port. This brother-in-law looked the other way so that the DeWolfs could keep breaking the law that had banned the slave trade in Rhode Island in the late 18th century and then subsequently nationally.
And you think Jefferson knew what was going on?
He definitely knew. It's not known for certain that he knew what he was doing when he appointed their brother-in-law, but people protested and said that this guy was not enforcing the law, and Jefferson did not fire him. So he definitely knew that he was helping the DeWolfs. Jefferson then subsequently introduced the federal legislation that banned the slave trade. So the contradiction is there again.
Did you learn stuff on this trip that you couldn't have learned if you just simply Googled the DeWolfs?
It's two things. One is when you start digging into something and you get things in your hands, so the actual archival documents that were at the Bristol Historic Society, it makes it incredibly real and hard to not have it hit you at a much deeper level when you've got the lists of, people sold at port and the slave lists from the plantations in Cuba, and then going to actual physical locations. So nothing can compare to visiting a dungeon in a slave fort in Ghana. And that, I think, led all of us to a level of empathy that in a funny way, it made me notice that I had a block against full empathy prior to that. I think because there's so much politics around the black-white dynamic in this country, and it's so incredibly loaded, it made me realize I had some kind of wall. It's like, well, of course slavery was horrible, and we all know that, and you don't need to tell us it was horrible. Of course it was horrible. But when you let go of that defensiveness and you actually fully empathize, then I'm now in a place where I can't imagine not being pissed off all the time if I were a black American.
But I'd imagine that the time distance makes it easier for you than, let's say, somebody, a German whose family had been implicated with the Nazi regime, or somebody who had actually worked at a concentration camp.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. I mean, if I were looking at something that my father had done or my grandfather had done, it would be that much harder. And part of what happened with all this, too, was realizing that this went so much further than our family. So at first it was a real personal reckoning, but then it grew to this much larger collective reckoning of, interesting that the North has gotten off the hook on slavery. How did that happen? And what do we, you know, if the North is as guilty as I now know they were on all kinds of levels, then suddenly the legacy of slavery is a national problem, not just a Southern problem.
Were there slaves in Rhode Island?
There were. All across the board in the North. There were – slavery existed for a good 200 years.
Yeah, well, New York was very sympathetic toward the South. And there was even talk about seceding along with the South at one point.
And absolutely, New York had an enormous slave population and was definitely part of the slave trade. And the resurgence of the slave trade in the 1850s was definitely coming out of New York.
My guest is Katrina Brown, who's directed a film called Traces of the Trade, a story from the deep North. When did you think about making a documentary? Was that there from the start?
I'm not a filmmaker by training, so it was a case of discovering this family history and then this larger regional history and deciding that it was a story that needed to be told and deciding to make a film at that point.
But you were both the filmmaker and a member of the family.
Right.
So you must have had a more complicated relationship to this whole thing. You couldn't maintain your objectivity all the time.
Right, which is why it's great that I had colleagues. So I had two co-directors, Jude Ray and Ala Kovgan, and amazing DP and co-producer Juanita Brown, who's African-American, who helped design the whole journey.
Would the trip have been different if it had been done in a more private way? Did engaging in this quest on film make it more difficult to deal with emotionally?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when I invited family members to consider coming on the journey, I said, you have to be willing to make a fool of yourself on national television if you're going to do this, because white folks, we do put our feet in our mouths and we don't always get it right. But I said, a lot of what prevents progress is that we're scared to open our mouths. So let's do it and let's risk it. And these folks agreed to that.
Was there a shared sensibility about your ancestors amongst the group?
There was a range of responses, and at the outset, some felt terribly guilty, some didn't feel guilty at all, and some.
It was so long ago. I have nothing to do with.
Yeah,
that.
It wasn't me, and some. We also had some who were more interested in the, black-white dialogue as being what's really needed. Others who felt like, as white folks, we need to get together with each other and work through stuff, so that we can show up for the conversation a little more clear-headed. So we did have a range within our group.
And you did put it within a religious context here as well. Most of you are members of the same church?
Not actually. A few of us are Episcopalian, and some aren't religious at all. There was a range, but a few of us did get very involved in the Episcopal Church, which has, in the last couple of years, passed a resolution to atone for its role in slavery. And what I've found is that, you know, I've drawn inspiration from the Truth and Reconciliation process in South Africa, which Archbishop Tutu was an Anglican, and he, you know, the theology of apology and atonement, and then questions about forgiveness obviously have religious roots, but they really apply to all of us, I think, as humans.
So were you able to resolve things, and could this experience be a cathartic one?
You know, yes, and there's so much more. So there's what I've really found is that this started me on a journey that will be for the rest of my life. So I learn and notice new things every day in terms of the black-white divide. And obviously it's just thrilling that our country is coming to raise these questions more. Senator Obama's speech in Philadelphia really put out a call for that I think is, I hope, will continue to resound. But so as a family, we learned a ton and we are definitely transformed, but there's further to go.
And I'm sure on this trip, you, as people who are deeply involved in this history felt both like insiders and outsiders.
Yeah.
In Ghana, was that something that was particularly apparent?
I mean, most of us, I don't think, had been in the minority before. So the simple experience of being among a few white faces it's a jolt, and it definitely gives one perspective that you might not have had before. And we were there at a time that was particularly intense because there were African Americans there who were doing basically homecoming pilgrimage to visit the slave forts that was parallel to ours, but obviously very different. And so we had some intense confrontations in meeting with folks there.
Also, it's one thing to think about this kind of history in the abstract. It's another thing to be confronted with the forts and see the places where they sailed from, and that really brings it home a lot more, doesn't it? In a very negative way for you emotionally.
Yeah, yeah, and both confronting the history and being with people there who were very much facing what do we have to deal with today, which, you know, who some would argue we need to do our work separately and that there needs to be space for Black Americans to do their work and white Americans to do theirs. And some would argue that we need to do it all together. But when you're walking on the same ground at the forts in the places, I think there is a way that you can realize that none of us actually created this history, but we all inherited it.
But there is a difference. In your case, your family actually, you know, ancestors who, as you said, are responsible for the kind of privilege that the people who went on this trip have enjoyed, Ivy League educations, et cetera, et cetera. They do bear more responsibility, don't they, than people like me whose ancestors came here at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century, who way after the Civil War have been fought.
I think it's a spectrum. So certainly our family can notice that we probably have more responsibility to show up for the work of repair today.
And is repair and reparation, which is another thing you discuss, and reconciliation, is that even a possible thing?
The people we talked to, lots of experts, including reparations leaders and people who are who believe something that needs to be done, but not with that approach. And we definitely came to feel like this is a question that the country needs to grapple with, and that even those, like you said, whose families came after the Civil War, I have Irish immigrant ancestors on my dad's side who worked in factories and struggled when they got here. But by the second and third generation, they were solidly middle class and solidly then upper middle class. And that was a trajectory that they could be on because they didn't face the extent of barriers that Black Americans have faced in the 20th century. So I do think I would never say that my DeWolf family history is a stand-in for all white America by any means. But I think anyone with white skin, we do need to look at these questions of repair. And we don't have to feel personally guilty or personally responsible or like our ancestors were in order to show up for what needs to be done today.
You looked into the way history is taught in history classes. Slavery is taught in history classes these days. You think that it's taught well?
Well, there are two things. One is that the role of the North in slavery is vastly, vastly undertaught. I mean, if anyone knows about that, it's in the South. But even there, I mean, people, it's not taught. So
because we're in a state of denial, or just so much more convenient to say the South is connected to slavery, we were the good guys, we won the Civil War.
Yeah, there's a constructed amnesia of sorts that I think is very understandable because no one wants to be related to bad guys, whether it's a family or an entire region. So it's easier. You know, the memory is long in the Black community and it's short in the white community, and it's even shorter in the North in terms of remembering that complicity. And yet it really does, you know, the victors write the history. So the North won the Civil War and we could paint ourselves as if we'd all always been abolitionists, as opposed to it had been a small minority that worked really hard to convince the larger culture.
What do people in Bristol, Rhode Island say about this?
Bristol is, you know, Linden Place is the family mansion that's now a museum. And there was definitely some discomfort initially, but they've really come to appreciate that this is a kind of dialogue that's beneficial, and that will, I think there's both in the family and in the town, there was a fear that it doesn't help to talk about these things. It'll make things worse to talk about these things and to bring it out. Why not just let sleeping dogs lie? But I think they've come to see the appreciation in the Black community in Rhode Island for the telling of this story. And so they've created they're creating an exhibit and a tour in town that will talk about the history of Bristol and the slave trade.
And is that one of your goals in making this film, to open up the dialogue?
Absolutely, yeah. And I encourage people to visit our website, which is tracesofthetrade.org, because we have a lot of materials. And POV, which is our broadcaster, has created an amazing discussion guide and lesson plans for classrooms and all of that, so people can use the film.
Well, you said that this is something that will be with you for the rest of your life. How do you plan to continue with this?
I'm trusting that it'll take me where it needs to. So I don't have another film in mind, as much as I suspect that I'll be sticking with these issues.
Mm-hmm. But you'll be talking to people, I guess, about it. Are you planning to make more films?
Nothing's brewing at the moment, so I'm going to certainly be out with this film for another year at least.
And what would you think would be a good way to proceed? To just talk about things? Should whites apologize to African Americans?
Well, Congressman Conyers has had a bill that he's introduced in Congress since 1989 called H.R. 40. And it's never had a hearing, but now that he's chair of Judiciary, he has the power to call the hearing, and he did in December. And he plans to do more around the country. And H.R. 40 is basically calling for the closest thing to a truth and reconciliation process in this country. We've never had one. And it would be to study the history and legacy of slavery and its aftermath and possible remedies. And that's the big conversation, is what are the remedies?
But, of course, the difference is truth and reconciliation in South Africa, for example, involved the people who have been engaged in the process.
Right.
We don't have anybody like that.
Right, but we all inherit that history. So we're fond of celebrating the 4th of July and remembering all the stuff we're proud of. We don't remember the rest, but all of it is still with us today.
Traces of the Trade, A Story from the Deep North, is going to be shown today at 1:30, which is just a short time away, and then again 9 o'clock tonight as part of the Human Rights Watch International Film Festival at the Walter Reed Theater, also broadcast on Channel 13 tomorrow night at 10. Thank you so much, Katrina Brown, for being on our show today.
Thank you for having me.